From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the program, Andy Warhol's athlete portraits are going to be on exhibit in Sacramento's Crocker Art Museum. We'll talk with a New York art collector who commissioned them and owns them. Also, On Tap, a new public TV documentary about the local history of beer. But first, the controversy over the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution. It gives Congress the power to regulate trade among the states. But critics say it has also taken away local control in favor of large companies. That's the premise of the new book, Gaveling Down the Rabble, by Jane Ann Morris. She's an anthropologist by training. Over the years, she's been an activist in a variety of issues, including energy, women's rights, peace, and the environment. Jane Ann Morris visits Sacramento and Davis this Sunday. Today, she joins us on the phone. Jane Ann Morris, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
How could the part of the Constitution that encourages free trade among the states also lead to an undermining of local control?
Well, first of all, the part of the Constitution says almost nothing. It just says that the Congress can regulate trade among the several states. It doesn't say free trade or specify that at all, and in fact, it wasn't even begun to be applied as so-called free trade until the 1870s. So, the idea that it was supposedly put there to enforce a free trade zone among the states is much later and was concocted by a combination of corporate lawyers and judges. So it's not really in the Constitution. Mm. It's an interpretation of it.
Do we know what the framers of the Constitution meant by commerce?
We do have an idea of why they put that in there. And if you look at the framers, who, let's remember, maybe represented 10 to 20% of the human beings in the population. So we're talking about a tempest in a pretty small teapot. But among the framers, there was a lot of difference of opinion. Some of them clearly wanted a strong central government to regulate trade and take charge of most anything, but many did not. And that was a fight between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. So we can say that among the framers, who represented a small part of the population, they disagreed about the role of trade and the role of the central government in regulating trade, and that's why the part that finally got into the Constitution says almost nothing.
Well, if I may quote from the Constitution, the Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. So, in your opinion, what does that mean, the Congress shall have power to regulate commerce among the several states?
Well, it means not very much. I mean, it's obviously left open and is left vague, which is what happens when two different factions are arguing about something and neither one of them can win out and out. They put something in that's vague and hope that later they can narrow it down. And in this case, the framers were pretty much 6 feet under by the time the U.S. Supreme Court, with the advice of corporate lawyers in the 1870s, began picking up on this phrase and using it as a way to free corporations from state regulation.
My guest is Jane Ann Morris, author of Gaveling Down the Rabble. It's a book about the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution and the impact that pro-free trade rulings by the U.S. Supreme Court have had on local and state control. She speaks in Sacramento and Davis this Sunday. Is the Commerce Clause the problem, in your opinion, or is it the way that the Supreme Court has interpreted it?
Well, the Commerce Clause, since it says very little, can't be the problem in itself. I think the problem is the sort of working together of the U.S. Supreme Court and corporate lawyers in the 1870s and 80s in a process that continues to this day. I think we sort of need a specific example. For example, a lot of states have passed fairly serious laws to preserve their water resources, laws against that water being pumped out of state or sold out of state, laws with reciprocity agreements between states and so on. And several of those laws, and I'm thinking of examples from Texas and Nebraska, which were clearly intended to conserve and protect a scarce resource, were declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court as trade barriers or as interference with interstate commerce. And you can find this in a lot of other areas, too, from recycling to conserving resources like natural gas, to protecting people against GMOs and so on, that many laws which were clearly set out there to preserve the general welfare of a state, including its resources and its human beings, were declared interference with interstate commerce. And a lot of legal historians, and I agree with them, have seen this as just a smokescreen for getting together between federal judges and corporate lawyers to free corporations from the state regulation that for a long time, in fact, did keep them under control.
From your point of view, this became a problem in the late 1800s. That's a long time that, quote-unquote, federal judges have been operating, I guess, in a way, on behalf of corporations. Are you saying that there's some kind of alignment between Supreme Court justices who've been appointed by who knows how many presidents of both parties over the decades?
Well, at that time, let's remember, most lawyers who got on the most people who were appointed to the Supreme Court were lawyers, and most of their experience was in corporate law, which at that time meant railroad law. And the ones that didn't have that experience tended to be from families that had owned slaves or continued to own slaves. So the people on the Supreme Court at that time were, you know, I have a little demographic analysis in my book, tended to be at least 80% clearly from the ruling class, no matter how you defined it, even much more so than now. So it's really no surprise that they saw eye to eye with corporate lawyers who were beginning to chafe under the effective application of state regulation.
Do you think that's still the case today? It seems like there's quite a bit of law professors and that type on the Supreme Court nowadays.
I think there may be a slightly wider variety, but we certainly don't have a bunch of bakers, butchers, and cabinet makers on the Supreme Court. You still are drawing from a really narrow group, and so it's kind of scary that they essentially have the power to call up and veto or not veto any law passed at any level within the United States, that's local, state, or federal.
Do you think that it's a problem that there is free trade among the states?
Well, I think that the issue really isn't free trade. In my book, I call it forced trade, because what's called free trade is essentially a way to prevent states from keeping in what they want to keep in, like resources and water, prevent them from keeping out things they regard as harmful and dangerous, and prevents them from keeping up standards that they think are appropriate, whether those are human rights standards or environmental standards. So it's really not about trade. It just gets called a matter of trade or commerce. It's really a matter of self-governance and democracy.
What do you think would have to change for society, for the United States to be run the way that you clearly think would be more appropriate, whereby there would not be a Commerce Clause interpreted in the way that it often is by the U.S. Supreme Court, and states would have complete liberty, or more or less complete liberty, to regulate themselves, including commerce?
Well, let's remember that our national government is a government of delegated powers, which means the Congress has only those powers specifically given to it by the Constitution, which is what Article 1, Section 8 is about. And all the other matters, as the 10th and 11th Amendments suggest, are to be left to the states or to the people. So that Congress is to have certain limited powers and other things like deciding where the train should stop and maybe deciding how many lanes you need on a highway or whether double trailer trucks are appropriate and so on. Those things have traditionally been left to locals and state people who, in fact, know their state better and are in better position to put in appropriate regulation.
I think it fits
very much in with a bioregional vision and a more self-reliant, sustainable vision and more locally oriented, which we should be thinking of now. I mean, the gas prices have brought that to a lot of people's attention, but I think we should have been thinking of it, you know, much earlier.
My guest is Jane Ann Morris, author of Gaveling Down the Rabble. It's a book about problems as she sees it and other critics see it with the Interstate Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution and the impact that rulings based on that by the U.S. Supreme Court have had on local and state control. Is this a conservative / liberal issue?
It's funny, it really isn't, because the usual analysis of the Supreme Court, are they liberal, are they conservative, really doesn't match this issue at all. Some of the people who have spoken most eloquently in favor of local and state power have been, well, like Rehnquist, people that I would consider reprehensible racist types. But on the other hand, there are a lot of good arguments for local power. And if you look at the people on the Supreme Court, one of the last state laws that was declared unconstitutional as a trade barrier was the California medical marijuana law. And so you had these conservatives who were supposed to favor local power, which would have meant they might have supported the law, finding that they didn't support the law. because it was maybe in content something they disagreed with. So they ended up favoring the federal government over the state. So this is an issue that really splits people differently than the traditional liberal conservative issues.
But didn't Clarence Thomas, who's considered very much a conservative, didn't he side with the states on a medical marijuana issue when it came to the Commerce Clause?
I don't remember.
Okay. Well, we'll move on from that one. How does this issue connect to the movement towards global free trade? In other words, commerce between nations as opposed to among the states?
Right. It's a great question. And in fact, the establishment of the so-called free trade zone within the United States, I believe, was a direct model for and a trial run for what's been going on with the World Trade Organization and agreements like NAFTA and CAFTA now. If you read over the arguments and the issues, they were over the same thing. They're over resources, water, quality of meat, food safety, and those are the same issues that have been dealt with by the World Trade Organization and NAFTA. And the same argument, you have an unelected tribunal, either the WTO tribunal or the U.S. Supreme Court, claiming that a local or national law is invalid because it's a so-called trade barrier. And the languages of trade and the languages of commerce, but the real issue is who governs. You know, are we self-governing or not? And what sorts of things may a national or state-level government, in fact, decide for themselves? So I think the fact that we continue to talk about it as though it were a trade or a commerce issue is really misleading and works right into their hands, because it isn't a trade or commerce issue, except peripherally. It's a governance issue.
You referred a minute ago to the U.S. Supreme Court as an unelected tribunal, and apparently with a negative inference there. But isn't that also part of the strength of the U.S. Supreme Court? Because I guess it's possible that if the Supreme Court were not unelected, the civil rights reforms of the 50s and 60s might not have happened.
That's a great question. The problem is that you could, you know, the Plessy versus Ferguson separate but equal doctrine was enforced for 58 years, during which some of the greatest horrors our nation have seen were perpetrated, you know, just lynching among many, many other things. And in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court didn't come out of the closet on civil rights until there were thousands of people in the streets, on the buses, and at drugstore counters all over the country. So I have a whole chapter on civil rights and Reconstruction and the role of the Supreme Court there, and it really turned my opinion around. I had thought also that the Supreme Court were the big saviors and helped us get out of these horrible civil rights abuses among those bad states, but I think when you look at the real history of it, it looks very different. First of all, the Supreme Court had a huge hand in crushing Reconstruction efforts, and that was a really horrible phase of our history. And secondly, when finally, the civil rights issue began to turn around. I don't think it was because of the Supreme Court. I think they were swept up in something much bigger than themselves, which, frankly, I wish had happened earlier. So they don't look quite so sweet and quite so heroic when you look at the actual history of the cases, I think.
Finally, Jean Ann, the Commerce Clause has been in the Constitution throughout the history of this country. It's been interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court in a certain way for well over 100 years. It has an impact on all aspects of life. And yet, it seems, I think, to most people, like a somewhat abstract issue. Why do you think this issue isn't more widely known and discussed?
Well, one of the reasons is because the real heavy work of establishing precedents for throwing out state and local laws was accomplished between 1870 and 1930. And then our country underwent a great deal of changes, and it just hasn't been picked up since then. Most of us around today don't have a living memory of the time when it really was controversial. And so one of the things I'm trying to do in this book is sort of resurrect it and sound an alarm that we are already living in the kind of free trade zone that people all over the world are fighting against at the international level, and that we should wake up to it and begin to confront it.
Jean Ann Morris, author of Gaveling Down the Rabble. It's a book about the way that the U.S. Supreme Court has interpreted the Constitution's Interstate Commerce Clause and how, in her opinion, that has had a negative impact on local and state control of many issues. She speaks this Sunday at the Avid Reader in Davis at 3 and in Sacramento at 7. Jean Ann Morris, thank you so much.
It's the reverse. It's in Sacramento at 3 and in Davis at 7.
I'm so sorry. Thank you for the correction. I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, Andy Warhol's athlete portraits. They're going to be on exhibit soon in Sacramento. We'll talk with a New York art collector who commissioned them. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Email us suggestions for future topics on Insight. Our address is insight@capradio.org. Local craft brewers and alcohol problem advocates are concerned about a new bill that would raise the promotional cap on beer merchandise. Tomorrow in Insight, what effect would this have on the beer industry in California? Also, the Sacramento Film and Music Festival kicks off this week. You'll meet two of the featured directors. And actress Dinah Linney on the memoir she wrote about the shocking murder of her high-profile father. A highlight collection of work by Andy Warhol opens this weekend in Sacramento. It's Warhol's portraits of famous athletes, and it's the centerpiece of a wider exhibit called American Pop. The Warhol athletes' pieces are owned by and were commissioned by art collector Richard Weissman, who was at one time a member of Warhol's inner circle. He joins us by phone from Seattle. Richard Weissman, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
What's the story behind Andy Warhol's athletes' portraits?
Well, I actually, as you said, was a fairly close friend of Andy Warhol, and I always had an interest in art and sports, and so I just thought it'd be a great idea to combine the two, since in most cases, people who are into sports are not exactly the biggest art fans in the world, and vice versa. So I thought it'd be great if he would do a series of sports stars.
Was Warhol interested in sports?
I'm sorry?
Was Warhol interested in sports?
Well, I think at the time we began, he may not have known the difference in a football and a golf ball. So but Andy was interested in everything, because you said, Andy, what do you think of this? He'd say, oh, gosh, that's such a great idea. Oh, yes, let's do it. Oh, yes. You know, I mean, about everything.
How did you decide which athletes would be featured?
Well, obviously, I was the one to do the deciding, since Andy wasn't really exactly the one to do that. So I just tried to pick people that, you know, were people that non-sports people would recognize, like, you know, Muhammad Ali at the time, Dorothy Hamill, Chris Everett, Jack Nicklaus, OJ for other reasons, and a few of them, like Rod Gilbert, probably not a household name, but he was a dear friend of mine, and I had to get this thing started somehow.
And how did Andy Warhol create these pieces?
Well, he did his portraits. I don't know, there's books out on that explain it better than I, but, I mean, he did Polaroid shots. I think he used the Polaroid called Big Shot, and he took photos, numerous photos, and then enlarged them, and sometimes took a nose from this and an ear from that and put it over in another one. I mean, he fixed them a little bit. And then he would screen them, you know, on a canvas, sometimes with the paint already on it and sometimes painting after. And then he would do his thing, so to speak.
Richard Weissman is an art collector. He was a friend of the late Andy Warhol. He commissioned Warhol's Athletes series, which is part of the American Pop exhibit, opening this Saturday at Sacramento's Crocker Art Museum. Richard, when the portraits were finished, were you happy with them, and was Andy Warhol happy with them?
Oh, yeah, we loved them, and the athletes especially loved them. I mean, you know, a lot of them, it's interesting because some of them, you know, didn't know Warhol, like Jack Nicklaus and Chris Everett were very concerned, well, what am I going to look like? I mean, this guy, isn't he weird? And then other people who you might not expect, like Muhammad Ali, who didn't finish grammar school, you mentioned Andy Warhol. He said, of course, I'd be happy to do it. And once he said he'd do it, everybody said they'd do it.
Yeah.
Rod Gilbert, of course, knew Warhol. Tom Seaver knew Warhol. The two that were a little skeptical was Chris Everett and Jack Nicklaus. They were a little worried about how they'd come out.
We'll talk a little bit more about Andy Warhol in a couple of minutes, but let's bring into the conversation Diana Daniels, an associate curator at the Crocker Art Museum. She's a curator of the American Pop exhibit that opens this weekend, including the Warhol Athlete Series. Diana, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
How important are the Warhol Athletes pieces in the context of American pop art?
Very important. By the late 1970s, Andy had portrait commissions, mostly for people of note for various reasons, and celebrity for sports stars was something that was increasing at the time. And Andy Warhol was regarded somewhat as the court painter to the stars.
Yeah. And what is American pop art?
American pop art is pop art by American artists, that's the obvious answer, but it's different than the variants that started in the 1950s in England. And we wanted to limit the scope of the exhibition, so we put the American on there as the modifier. So,
and why is it called pop?
Pop art was coined primarily, it's attributed to Lawrence Alloway, who was an English art critic, and he came up with it just as a sort of a response to the way British artists were drawing in things from popular culture, such as magazine advertisements.
So it was not connected to the use of the word pop as in pop music?
No, but there was kind of a perpetual feedback that started to happen once they started calling things pop art. So really the term pop originates with the art movement.
What is it about the Warhol Athlete series that makes them an example of American pop art? Obviously, the American part we've taken care of because Warhol was an American artist. But what is it about those portraits that makes them pop art?
The celebrityness, the American fascination with celebrity. In this case, it's particularly American, the fascination with the sports stars and the sports that were picked by Mr. Weissman mm-hmm. to be represented, which include tennis and football and basketball. And golf.
One of them wasn't American, I think.
Pele.
But I think the others
were.
Yeah,
Pele.
Oh, right. Richard, how did you meet Andy Warhol?
You know, that's a question I've been asked, and I really don't know. You know, Andy was quite social. I mean, we used to joke and say that he would go to the opening of an envelope. And, you know, I met him way back when, you know, just through, you know, the art world. But I think I got to know him. Through the social world, because those were the days of Studio 54 and a lot of stuff like that. And he was at it all. I mean, he had energy like I've never seen anyone who could go to five or six things every day and another four or five every night.
What was he like when the doors were closed? There were no cameras there, no celebrities around.
He was pretty much the same. I mean, Andy was. Actually, when the celebrities were around, he was kind of quiet. He'd sit in the back. He'd like to take pictures. Now, he was a groupie. I mean, Andy was the ultimate groupie. And, you know, when you're with him alone, and the only time I think I ever remember him, you know, being a little different is he didn't like to fly alone. So when we were in London, I flew back with him on the Concorde, just the two of us alone. And he started making remarks and started to talk to me about my two daughters and I couldn't even believe the insight and the intelligence. I mean, he knew and said things that, I mean, just kind of like, I can't believe how he would be that perceptive. It was amazing. You know, I mean, help me out, I can tell you.
Yeah. Earlier you said that a couple of the athletes who were asked if they wanted to be portrayed by Warhol said, you know, something along the lines of, isn't he weird? Was he weird?
Well, I don't know. You know, I mean... Let me put it this way. When we were doing the Jack Nicklaus portraits, you know, Andy asked him to move his stick a little bit, and Jack said, stick? That is not a stick. That's my golf club. And I said, Jack, just relax. Andy, you know, it's okay. You know, it's like stick club. I mean, just could you move the thing? I mean, and so forth. And that's like he was, I don't know. I mean, I think he was someone who liked everyone. You know, he was just, I mean, I just... I think he was weird, I guess, because he had white hair, a white hair wig. Mm-hmm. But I think we've all seen weirder than that, right?
Yes, indeed. What was it about his work, his artwork, that you enjoyed?
That I enjoyed?
Yeah.
Well, I liked the fact that he, you know, he was doing things that basically, you know, seemed very everyday. But, you know, he had an eye for things. when we went on various trips to do some of his portraits, I mean, he would go to a motel, we'd walk in the room, and he'd, like, go into the bathroom and say, oh, this is so amazing. Just look at this. It's so incredible. And they were the little soaps and the little colognes and the little hand creams that were in all of the bathrooms. And he was just like, I mean, he could see that this was like the beginning of these hotels and motels spurting up all over America and the beginning of an era. And, I mean, I looked at it like, what are you looking at? I mean, they're little soaps. Oh, but they're so amazing. Oh, you know. And he would take them. And he had these time capsules. I mean, Diane, you probably know about this. I mean, they're buried somewhere. I mean, he'd fill up one a week if you'd let him.
Yeah.
They're on display at the Andy Warhol Museum.
Yeah. Richard Weissman is an art collector. He was a friend of the late Andy Warhol. He commissioned Warhol's Athlete Series, which is part of the American Pop exhibit, opening this Saturday at Sacramento's Crocker Art Museum. Richard Weissman joins us by phone from Seattle. In our studio, Diana Daniels, who's curator of this exhibit. The Warhol Athlete Series is a centerpiece. But there are some local American pop art artists represented. Like
right.
Who?
Wayne Thiebaud, though he himself prefers to consider himself a realist painter, but his part of the story of pop art is very important. He showed with the Allen Stone Gallery in New York as pop art was arriving on the scene with Andy Warhol's first shows. And his subject matter was every day. It was cakes and pies, and those are on display in the museum. And while there's a very serious side to Wayne's observations, he will forever be wrapped up with the pop art movement, and he is probably the most significant artist to come out of the Sacramento region.
And Barbara Spring as well, it's a local connection.
Barbara Spring as well. She works in Big Sur, but was also in Sacramento at the time, and it was kind of a spirit of the time, this move towards things that were the little things that you generally take for granted, like those hotel soaps that Richard Weissman was talking about. And she, too, was doing foodstuffs as her subject.
Mm-hmm.
And Mel Ramos, of course, with his pinup girls, was channeling something that was very much a part of the post-war spirit. And he was born and raised in Sacramento, graduated from Clatchy High School.
Richard Weissman, your family has a long history of collecting art.
Yes, they do. It's kind of well. First of all, when you had mentioned I'm a New York collector. I used to be a New York collector. Now
yes.
I'm kind of a Seattle collector. But I think that my uncle collected Impressionists, and then I think my father didn't want to copy my uncle. I don't think he could have, because that'd have been a pretty amazing feat to accomplish, copying Norton Simon's collection. Or not copying it, but taking, you know, mm-hmm. doing the same thing. So then he went and kind of did contemporary. And but he kept saying he wasn't doing it because of Norton. It had nothing to do with Norton. And I guess I might have done the same thing. I'm not that interested in it. And the next thing I know, I was buying a painting at 20 years old by the name of artist by the name of Mata. So, and now I see my son, who's 15. He's got, a Kenny Scharf and an Arnaldi in his room, along with pictures of 50 Cent and Lil Wayne. So
something in the blood.
I guess it goes on. But, I mean, we all have been into it and really enjoy it. But my son will tell you, he doesn't like it.
What is it you enjoy about collecting art?
Well, I just feel, each painting, I mean, people ask me what painting I like the best, and I don't have an answer because I like every one. I wouldn't have it if I didn't like it. And I go from room to room, and each room is a different message. I like to move them around. This one goes there, that one goes there. They don't have particular places. I mean, good paintings look good anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, anywhere. I love the Impressionists, but I can't afford the Impressionists. I have modern paintings. I have, Max Ernst and Tanguy and, Picasso. I mean, it's not just pop. I'd love to have had the Pre-Raphaelites, but Guy Andrew Lloyd Webber beat me to the punch and drove the prices up. So.
Wow. So
I would love those. And Spielberg did the same thing with Norman Rockwell. And I have a few Norman Rockwells, but then Spielberg came in and just started buying them. How was that?
Security must be an issue at your house. I mean, you must have, I can't even imagine what the value of the artworks in your home must be.
Well, you know, the security, it's not, you know, people aren't going to come in and steal a painting. I mean, what are they going to do with it? I mean, I guess you could do something with it, but it's not like they couldn't sell it to, you know, the Crocker, I don't think.
Exactly.
You know, they know what's going on. I mean, I have security, don't get me wrong, but I mean, you know, the art, my insurance company says I better have security or they won't insure it.
Yeah.
But, you know, and the prices, you know, continually, Diane will tell you, I mean, you know, these things are continually being revalued and in most cases on the upward side. I mean, they're, you know, I'm shocked sometimes to hear, you know, the prices of some of these paintings because I'm not into it to sell them.
How much do you think one of the Warhol portraits would go for if it were sold on the market?
Well, I mean, the set is insured for $25 million, okay? So, I mean, I don't know if that tells you anything.
Yeah.
My daughter lives in Rome, says she thinks that's, you know, ridiculously low. I don't know. I really don't look at art from the standpoint of the monetary situation. I mean, I just look at it because I enjoy it. I mean, the only time monetary comes in is if you have to pay for something.
My last question for you, Richard Weissman. Some people see artwork on their walls as just an extension of their decor, whereas other people, it's a very different thing. The very notion of blending your furniture with the artwork in your walls is abhorrent. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I think, as I just said, I mean, paintings, I mean, my painting, I can go anywhere. I mean, I don't care what the decor of a house is. I mean, you take, you know, I mean, obviously I could say a good Rembrandt or Renoir or Monet, but let's just go and say, you know, a Lichtenstein, okay, or a Jasper Johns. I mean, a Lichtenstein is a cartoon, okay? But, I mean, it could go anywhere. I mean, I had a beautiful Lichtenstein called Blonde Waiting, and my wife, when we got married, said, is that thing going to come in our apartment? I mean, that blonde? And I said, well, you know, yeah. And so then I sent it on tour. It was going away for like 18 months. I came home from work. You know, the people came over and took that painting? I said, I thought you didn't like it. But the whole room just collapsed.
What I like about the collaboration between the Crocker and Richard Weissman is part of Richard's message is that art is something to be lived with and art something to enjoy. And Richard Weissman, Richard himself, will say that when he first started collecting, while he did make some great choices in the case of Andy Warhol, etc., there were people who mocked his choices in what he bought. But he bought what he wanted, what he liked, lived with it, continues to live with it. And certainly the valuation has a life of its own, but it does not diminish in one bit the pleasure that Mr. Weissman takes in sharing it with a wider audience.
Plus the fact I have numerous paintings and artists that you've never heard of and never will. And I love them every bit as much. I mean, Barton Bennis. I don't think many people have heard of Barton Bennis or Matty Barang, people like that. And they're right here in my home, right next to Lichtenstein and Warhol and, you know, Rothko and everything else. You know, it's just, I'm just not into the monetary situation on it.
That's Richard Weissman, art collector in Seattle. He was a friend of the late Andy Warhol. He commissioned Warhol's Athlete Series, which is part of the American Pop exhibit opening this Saturday at Sacramento's Crocker Art Museum. Richard Weissman on the phone, Diana Daniels at the Crocker Art Museum in our studio. Thank you both very much for joining us.
We thank you for the interview, and I'll probably be in town this weekend, Diane. So
all right, looking forward to it.
Very good. Thanks. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up on tap, it's a new TV documentary about the local history of beer. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can podcast Insight. Sign up at capradio.org/insight. Coming up this afternoon from KXJZ News, the California Senate's top Democrat says he's reached a budget deal with Republican Governor Schwarzenegger, but Senator Parada says the deal still needs Republican lawmaker votes. Also, the latest fundraising reports are out in the race for Sacramento mayor. Where do the candidates stand financially heading into the stretch run? Those stories later today on All Things Considered. Beer is one of the human race's earlier inventions, and it's given lots of pleasure, plus a helping of misery, to many people over the millennia. And yet, for some reason, beer just doesn't have the mystique or get the respect given to other alcoholic drinks like wine or whiskey. A new local public TV documentary aims to help fix that. It's called On Tap, and it premieres tonight on KVIE Sacramento's PBS station. We have two key members of the Sacramento area brewing community in our studio. We'll start there with Brian Shadden, the producer of On Tap. Brian, welcome back to Insight.
Hi, thank you.
Why did KVIE decide that beer was interesting and important enough to get a local documentary?
You know, it actually started a few years ago. I was here on Insight talking about baseball in Sacramento, and I learned that if it wasn't for beer, there wouldn't have been baseball in Sacramento. So that was actually the start of me thinking about, you know what, I think beer might need its own documentary.
Remind us of that. People weren't just drinking beer at baseball. What role did beer play in bringing baseball to Sacramento?
Beer was integral to bringing baseball to Sacramento. Actually, one of the first ballparks was built just outside of the city limits for the sole reason so they could sell beer at the stadium. So it was, and one of the first teams was called the Gilt Edge, which was a brand of Buffalo beer. So beer and baseball have gone back for a long, long time in Sacramento.
And that Buffalo Brewing Company, beer company, was a local company.
It was very. It was one of the early beer companies in Sacramento. There were several breweries in Sacramento at one time, but that was the biggest, and at one time it was the largest on the west of the Mississippi.
And you can see a legacy of that company in the Rustaller building at 9th and J Streets in Sacramento. That was their headquarters.
It was their business office and tap room. So that is really the one big thing that's still standing. Yeah.
Brian Shadden, producer of On Tap. It's a new documentary about beer. It premieres tonight at 7 on KVIE. Now, the documentary really starts out talking about the renaissance of beer, craft beer making in the United States. Why did it get so bad?
Prohibition. Yeah, I make the argument that actually in the years after Prohibition, post-World War II, that, you know, after World War II, the country's highway system got much better. The brewing process got much more industrialized, and the big Midwest brewers could sell very cheaply coast to coast. And for a variety of reasons, that put nearly every small brewer in the country out of business. So for the 30 years post-World War II, I call it the Dark Ages for beer in America, because for that 30 years, basically beer tasted like Budweiser, all the same.
Let's listen to a clip from the documentary. This is where the host of On Tap, Gary Gelfand, is in San Francisco at the Anchor Brewing, which is a well-known company. And I thought it was a fairly recent craft brewing company, but in fact, it's a pretty old brewer. And it was in hard times, and it almost closed in the 1960s.
But in walks Fritz Maytag and the Maytag Appliance family. Story goes like this. He walks into a bar in San Francisco's North Beach, sits down, orders the only beer on tap, which happens to be an Anchor. The owner walks by and says to him, "You better get that while you can, because Anchor is done."
So Fritz marches down to the brewery and ends up buying a majority stake in a company that at the time only had $128 in its bank account.
And Fritz Maytag brought science to the brewery, didn't he?
He brought science to that brewery. Yes, he did. And that was a big part of his speech, is that if it wasn't for science, he wouldn't have turned that brewery around. And science has played a huge role in breweries, but also breweries have played a huge role in science. Peter could talk about that quite a bit.
Peter being Peter Hoey, brewmaster at Sacramento Brewing Company. Welcome.
Hi. Yeah, the thing that I really like about the brewing industry is it's very dynamic and multifaceted in terms of the production of beer. You have to be a little bit of a chemist, a little bit of a physicist, a little bit of an artist, and a little bit of even a salesman to some degree to make sure that your beer is available for people to buy. So, you know, the science is very important, but also there's an artistry, especially for these small-batched craft beers that I make and that a lot of my colleagues make.
When you say science, what do you mean?
You have to know things like heat transfer. I mean, you know, how your equipment boils beer and how to chill it and maintain proper temperatures. There's a lot of enzymatic reactions that take place when you're mixing malted barley with water in order to create the sugars that the yeast will go and eat and produce CO2 and ethyl alcohol. There's a whole biochemistry taking place during the fermentation process where, like I said, the yeast are eating those sugars and making the alcohol. So there's you have to know a little bit about a lot of things to do it well.
It's Peter Hoey at the Sacramento Brewing Company. Also with us, J.J. Jackson, owner of the original homebrew outlet in Sacramento. J.J., welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Do you need to be a scientist to make beer at home?
No, all you need to do is have the ingredients and ability to keep things clean and be patient. And if you can boil water, you can make beer. If you can make oatmeal, you can make better beer.
Well, I can do that. How good can the beer be that realistically that you make at home?
It can be just as good, if not better, than most of the beers you can buy at a store. It's going to be fresher. It's going to have a lot better vitamin content. It's going to have live yeast, which is going to be B-complex vitamins. The only thing you have to watch is it does have a lot more sugars than the beers in the stores.
Now, you're featured in this KVIE documentary on tap, but I understand that you have another connection to KVIE because you do beer judging.
Yes.
And your first judging happened to be at the KVIE facilities.
Yeah. I organized and have been organizing the commercial craft brewing competition for the California State Fair, which the public tasting is coming up on August 22nd here at the fair. So you can taste the best of California beers. And the very first year that we organized it, we went along and rented out the hall at KVIE and held our judging there. And we learned quite a bit and also learned they had some freezers marked as refrigerators, mm-hmm. which didn't make the stouts very good.
Now, getting back to On Tap, Brian Shadden, the producer, early in the show, we see a map of Northern California with three mm-hmm. communities that mm-hmm. have important roles to play in the revival of craft brewing in America. And we talked about one, San Francisco, with the Anchor Brewing Company. There's also Chico with the Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. But there's also Sonoma.
Yeah. Sonoma and New Albion. I think that's what a lot of the craft brewers really look to as the first. It's considered the first microbrewery in America. And I think that's just one of the fascinating things about this show is that from those 30 years where beer all tasted the same to now where we have 1,500 craft breweries in America, that birth of that really started right here in our backyard in Northern California in these three cities.
Including as an academic center, UC Davis, Gary Gelfand, the host of On Tap, talks with Don Barkley, who was there at the very early days of New Albion Brewing. Here he is.
I had originally gone to University of California, Davis, and I went there and I talked to Dr. Michael Lewis and I said, you know, where can I get some brewing experience? And of course, he saw a beard and long hair, and he said, you know, your experience probably won't go anywhere. You know, the first thing you need to do is cut your hair, and then you can get a job in the brewing industry, because back in 77, I mean, that's where the brewing industry was. But I got to go to the New Albion Brewing Company and work with Jack McAuliffe. So that was the very first microbrewery to open up in the United States, and boy, did we have a good time. You know, I didn't get paid anything at all that first year.
Peter Hoey, J.J. Jackson, how strong is the craft brewing community in Sacramento? Let's start with Peter.
It's going really strong in Sacramento. I think we really have one of the most underrated in the public eyes brewing communities here. We have nationally award-winning breweries, including Rubicon Brewing Company consistently wins medals at the Great American Beer Festival and World Beer Cup. My brewery, Sacramento Brewing Company, wins at World Beer Cup and Great American, and even Elk Grove Brewing, just a little south of us, has won Small Brewery of the Year at the Great American. And those are the biggest national domestic competitions. So, I mean, you bring the best of the best to those festivals. And, you know, three breweries that are within a stone's throw of each other do very, very well in all of those competitions.
Oh, J.J. Jackson, you do statewide judging. How is Sacramento doing as a region?
Oh, it's very strong. It's it's one of the one of the best regions because it has a lot of resources. UC Davis is right here. It has one of the national level schools. It turns out master brewers, a lot of master brewers. They're very sought after by large companies such as Anheuser-Busch and Coors. And we have a very active homebrewing community too. It's one of the three original homebrew groups in the state, and we are very competitive. We have one of the three of the three homebrew competitions that make up the Sierra Nevada Homebrewer of the Year competition. And one of those is the Mayfair in Los Angeles. The second one is the California State Fair Homebrew Competition, and the third one is the California State Homebrew Competition in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So this is a very active community. A lot of people come up through the homebrewing community to become professional brewers, right, Pete?
Absolutely. I got my I was a homebrewer, and I was buying my ingredients from JJ almost 10 years ago now. Yeah. And he said, hey, you know, Sacramento Brewing Company is looking for an assistant brewer. And that's how I got my start in the industry.
The rest is history.
Yeah.
Brian, you can't make a local documentary about beer without talking to Charlie Bamforth, the yes. famous brew
yes.
Expert at UC Davis. And in On Tap, he talks with the On Tap host, Gary Gelfand, about the health benefits of beer, which we did talk about in the past with Charlie Bamforth, but he's so good on the topic. Let's listen to him again.
The key ingredient in any alcoholic beverage that cuts down the risk of your arteries from blocking is alcohol. And it really doesn't matter if that's red wine, white wine, beer, or anything else in the same equivalent quantities. So beer actually has the same benefit as wine to cut down the risk of your blood vessels from clotting. But there's more, you see, because beer at the same equivalent quantities of alcohol contains more nutrition. Beer contains some antioxidants, beer contains B vitamins, and beer contains silica. Beer and bananas are two richest sources in the diet. So beer actually is better for you.
Okay, and of course all in moderation. You don't want to sit there and...
In total moderation. A couple of beers a day, nectar.
I've tried to explain this many times to my wife, but Charlie says it so much better.
Doesn't he, though?
Finally, let's go back to our local beer experts and ask them, what's your favorite Sacramento area beer? Peter Hoey. And feel free to choose one from Sacramento Brewing Company,
well,
if you wish.
I do have to choose my own. I really like hops, and it's hard to find a beer. Well, I actually haven't found a beer that's too hoppy for me, so I would pick my double IPA that we brew every January called Independence Ale. It's 8.5%. It's very strong. Probably one of those would take care of Charlie's you know, two measures of alcohol.
And if you didn't work at Sacramento Brewing Company, do you still think that would be to your taste?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's the style of beer that I'll reach for 9 times out of 10.
That's why you make it
if it's available. Yeah. So
and JJ Jackson,
I would have to choose probably a Maibock from Sudwerk Brewing in Davis. There's not all due respect to ales. I really like the clean dry lager taste, and Jay Prahl, the brewer out there, does an excellent job at producing a German style beer. It's a good example. We have really great selection in this area of different styles, including Belgian style beers that Pete's working on. We have lagers out in Sudwerk. There's a lot of different ales that are around. Lots of different kinds of Hefeweizens for the pleasure.
And Brian Shadden, what do you quaff?
Well, I'm sitting about a foot away from the master brewer at Sacramento Brewing Company, so I'm going to go with Sacramento Brewing Company, of course. I'll go with their Sac Squatch.
Very good. So, Brian, On Tap premieres tonight?
Tonight at 7 o'clock.
Okay.
Yep, that's it.
Very good. Well, we've been talking about On Tap. It's a new KVIE public TV documentary about the local history and the benefits of beer. It airs tonight at 7. The producer, Brian Shadden, joined us along with Peter Hoey, brewmaster at Sacramento Brewing Company, and JJ Jackson, owner of the original homebrew outlet in Sacramento. Thank you all very much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Coming up on KXJZ, a familiar name in Northern California retailing will soon disappear with the upcoming purchase of Long's Drugstore by CVS. Plus, how one family has handled change in these hard economic times. Those stories and the rest of the day's business news next on Marketplace. Today's associate producer, Lynn Weaver. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The assistant producer, Robin Souza. The senior producer is Jen Picard. And thank you for joining us. Local craft brewers and alcohol problem advocates are concerned about a bill that would raise the promotional cap on beer merchandise. On the next Insight, what effect would this have on California's beer industry? Also, the Sacramento Film Festival kicks off this week. You'll meet two of the featured directors. And actress Dinah Linney on the memoir she wrote about the shocking murder of her high-profile father. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
That's tomorrow.